The matches of the Euro will be split into 13 packages. 12 cities who would include 3 group stage matches and 1 knockout round, 8 final or quarter final, and 1 city which would host the semi-finals and the finals.
Dublin is in with a shot to be a host city for Euro 2020. The European Championships will be split across the whole of Europe, 13 different cities. It remains to be seen just how it's going to work. This is the Why Big Football Show. I'm Dave O'Grady. We're going to be looking at the Euro 2020 Championships shortly on the show. We're going to also be discussing Ireland's end-of-season friendlies with Turkey and Italy, and then the trip to the USA to take on Costa Rica and Portugal, Ireland playing two of England's group stage World Cup counterparts. We'll see what happens there. We're also going to be looking at the Carlsberg National Five-A-Side Tournament taking place on the June bank holiday weekend. I'll be chatting to Pete Kelly of Extra Time for more information on that. And we'll have our usual snippet from the League of Ireland Goalmouth Show, where I'll be catching up with Ronan Murphy of Goal Ireland for all the gossip in the league this week. Remember, if you'd like to contact the Why Big Football Show, you can simply email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. We're also at talkingsport.org on Twitter, and it's facebook.com/talkingsport.org. That simple. Well, looking at the international scene over the past few months, there's been a lot of talk about Europe 2020, a tournament with a difference, as many host cities are going to be going in to host the championships. It's going to be spread across the whole of Europe. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, we don't know. Sepp Blatter thinks it's going to be good because it's only going to be kind of a once-off, but we'll see how it materializes. I'm delighted to be joined by Reuters' Philip O'Connor and Joe McCarthy of the Irish Players Abroad website. Philip, to come to yourself first on this Euro 2020, it's going to be quite different to what we're used to. Do you think it's going to be a good thing because we're going to have so many countries across the whole of Europe hosting this tournament, hosting games? It's going to be kind of, some people say it's going to be hard to keep track of all this. We're used to just one or two countries sharing the hosting. How do you think it's going to go?
I think the whole thing is going to be hugely confusing, Dave, both when it comes to the qualification process and as well as the actual hosting of it. If you remember the sort of the great tournaments of our time, you know, you had Germany in 1988. We just had the Poland and Ukraine in 2012. Part of the attraction is that it's quite simple. We all go to the one place or two places and we play football and that's it. Now, if you have it spread out across, you know, 6 or 7 cities, some of which are not known for their footballing infrastructure, you have to wonder, where is the attraction going to come from? Is it just going to seem like, you know, a very diffuse, diverse set of games? I think that's a kind of a risk. The idea that, okay, we're celebrating 60 years of the European Championships, that's all well and good. But personally, I'd rather they stuck to it and maybe even just go back to having the best teams that it reduced to 16, you know. But I think it's going to be chaos.
Yeah, I'm kind of struggling with the concept myself, Philip, because we've seen FIFA and UEFA, they have said it is going to be a once-off, but is it going to take something a little bit away from the Euros? Because as you said, we have had the history, we've had Germany, we've had Euro 96 with England and the penalty shootouts and stuff like that. And you know, one of the things about hosting international major tournaments, Philip, is it's giving the country a chance to showcase what they can do at an international level.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant, both in terms of tourism and in terms of sport. It very much focuses the mind in terms of these places. But certainly over the last 15 or 20 years, it feels like the decisions are becoming more and more commercially driven. We're seeing countries that are being awarded big tournaments that aren't prepared for them at all. I'm going to Brazil now in about 5 or 6 weeks' time, and Brazil is not ready. The stadiums aren't finished. The Olympics, the same thing. The Winter Olympics there in Sochi, and they were still sort of, you know, nailing things up. Yeah. As people were... by. And I think that's, you know, it's really it's very, very difficult thing to do. Why are they doing this? If you look at the list of cities that are involved, I'm sitting here in Stockholm. It's the Friends Arena. The Friends Arena is partially owned by the Swedish Football Association, but it's a commercial entity. Obviously, they want big games there. The Amsterdam Arena, the Stadio Olimpico, the Aviva Stadium. I mean, it might be owned in part by the FAI, but it's also very much being run as a commercial venue, you know. And I have to say, I'm convinced that we're not doing this for the good of football. This is not for the good of football. It's not for the good of the players. It's not for the good of the fans. It's to do with the commercial attraction of the game. And they're trying something here as a once-off. I mean, they're saying it's a once-off, but of course, you know, if it's seen to be a success, then UEFA will have, you know, the next thing will be to play the European Championships in Asia.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with that, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if they're bringing Aviva Premiership rugby matches over to certain countries. There's talk of Old Firm games as well in the future from Celtic Rangers going over to Abu Dhabi or something. I can see exactly where you're coming from. Joe McCarthy, to come to you on this, what do you make of it? And particularly from an Irish point of view, how big is it that we're going in for this? And if we get it, how huge will that be for Dublin? Aviva Stadium, one of the stadiums looking for some of that action.
How you doing, Dave? I think it could be massive for Dublin, and if they do get one of the host cities of the tournament. Actually, I think we proved with the recent hosting of the Europa League final that we can handle an influx of tourists at that level. I think, you know, it was a great occasion, and I think it will be a great advertising for the country. The Aviva Stadium is I don't want to say unique, but it's definitely special in that it's fairly centrally located within the city, and you know, it's within walking distance of the city centre. You know, I think if you go to somewhere like Wembley, it's very much outside of the city centre. So there's when there's a big game on, you know, the you can feel it around Dublin. You know, when there's a rugby match on or an international being staged, there's a great buzz around the city. And I think, you know, when the stadium is outside the city centre, some of that energy is lost. I think we have a good chance of being granted one of the as a whole city, and looking forward to the process now. As for whether or not it's a good thing for football, I think it remains to be seen. My initial reaction when I heard it was that this was a bad idea, like for all the reasons that Phil gave there. You know, a tournament is very much a focal point for the fans. I mean, I have great memories of being around Poznan Square and in Gdansk during the European Championships, and mixing around with the different fans from the various countries that were involved over the week and a half that I was there. And obviously that's not going to happen if it's only, say, you know, Spain coming to Dublin for one game, and then, you know, the fans are leaving again. It wouldn't really be much difference from a qualification game.
Yeah,
I think one of the counter arguments that they're giving is that it could mean for a smaller country, like, say, I think I read that Luxembourg had actually applied, or possibly Liechtenstein had applied to be a host city. So it could mean, you know, a large international or a big draw in terms of international soccer coming to their area, to their stadium, which obviously, you know, they wouldn't see a lot of, which again, you know, it's a boost for the area. It's a boost for the soccer or football setup in the city. If it's just a one-off, yeah, I think we've all heard of, you know, things that are going to be one-offs that, you know, have gone on to become mainstays in the game. Whether or not, you know, I know Phil, you know, we laughed at the suggestion that we could be seeing the European Championships played in Asia, but, you know, we see American football games played in Wembley and now across Europe. There was the talk of the 39th Premier League game that never really came to anything. And of course, you know, every summer we have the Premier League Asia Cup, you know, played in Southeast Asia as part of the pre-season. So, you know, we laugh now, but it's not really that fanciful an ocean.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Philip, just on some of the countries, and as Joe said, Ireland in with a chance. Is it maybe Ireland's chances will be heightened, I think, by the likes of some of the countries that are struggling? I know there was a lot of controversy over Jerusalem in Israel getting going in, and people saying they shouldn't be taking it. I know Spain have a couple of cities in there, Madrid, Barcelona, Bilbao, Valencia. Wales have the Millennium Stadium, and Scotland have Hampden Park. And of course, your own neck of the woods, as you said, the Friends Arena in Stockholm, no doubt that's well able for it. But do you think Ireland, because of the track record, as Joe was saying, with the Europa League and that, we have a good chance?
I think so. I think Dublin is a very sort of tourist-friendly city. It's a very sports-friendly city. I think the biggest card that we have in our hand at the moment is the fact that we're owed by the international football community, thanks to Thierry Henry a few years ago. And I would be very, very surprised if the opportunity isn't taken to make it up to the Football Association of Ireland by granting them one of these things. But one of the things that I would question is, what is the long-term benefit of this, right? What, like, we talk about it being a great honour and a great sort of thing for tourism and that kind of thing. I've been to a lot of these tournaments. I've been to a lot of these places. And like, I've always wanted to go back a year to the day after the Open and see what the difference is. And I can tell you, I covered the Women's Euros 2013 there here in Sweden. And the effect that it's had on the women's game here is negligible. Okay, there was a huge interest during the summer last year, but now it's completely gone. And that says to me that, you know, if you're trying to do something for the grassroots of the game, this is not it. So spreading the games around 10, 12, 15 countries or bringing them to Asia, it's not having the positive effect that people would want to have. And that's why it leads me to believe that, you know, if you're not making these decisions for football reasons, then you're doing it for commercial reasons. I would really dearly love to see the FAI maybe say, look, you know, we'll back out of this and we'll concentrate on getting our house in order financially, because these things aren't cheap either, Dave. There's going to be huge resources demanded, both of the Football Association of Ireland to secure the games and then of the Irish government to police it, to make sure the airport is hoovered and everything else like that, you know. So I think that these are definitely things that we have to take into account. Only this morning, Norway was discussing the fact that, you know, they're not really sure if they can afford a state guarantee for an Olympic bid. I think the way Ireland's finances are at the moment, the best resource the best use of football's resources would actually be in investing in the grassroots rather than, you know, the baubles on the Christmas tree.
I think a lot of people will agree with you there. Just before I leave this topic, Philip, is there countries that you do think will probably not be considered by UEFA for this? I mean, we've seen, as I said, we have the likes of Israel and that, and maybe Ukraine, Donetsk, with the political situation there, that could affect the decision. You have Belarus in there looking for it. Baku in Azerbaijan, I know they do play in Europe and they are in the Eurovision and that, but they're quite far away as well. Armenia, Yerevan, places we've been to. Any places you don't think have any hope of hosting this?
Well, I think what you'll probably see is that the big countries that have a previous track record in organising these tournaments will get it. Sweden will probably get it. Ireland will get it. Italy, Germany, the Netherlands, England, Denmark probably. I'd say what you'll probably get as well is that, you know, one of the minnows will get it. So it might be Azerbaijan, it might be Belarus, it might be Romania, or it might be Macedonia.
Kazakhstan. There'd be a bit of a time difference there as well.
It would, yeah. I mean, like, that's, and the logistics of saying, okay, where do you go from here, you know, in terms of, I know these things have, you know, I mean, FIFA and UEFA are absolutely brilliant when it comes to the logistics of things. They plan things out, they throw resources at it. But again, like, you know, how are you going to plan TV schedules around this? One of them will get it, but I'd say the rest, because it's not politically expedient. There's no gain for the games. There's no gain for the football associations in awarding it to both Azerbaijan, Belarus and Macedonia. So I don't think that that's going to be something that will happen. I'd say because of this 60th anniversary thing, they're going to go with the classic footballing countries and the ones that have the infrastructure to do it.
Well, from an Irish point of view, we'd have to say best of luck to the FAI and Ireland if we do get to host a couple of these cracking games, and it would be even more special if Ireland were in it, but they'll probably introduce a law where you can't play in your own country or something. It remains to be seen. I want to focus now on the Irish international team, lads, and look at the upcoming friendlies at the end of the season. Joe, to come to yourself, we've got one home game and one match in Craven Cottage against Italy before we embark on our tour of America. We're taking on Turkey on Sunday the 25th of May, 6 o'clock kickoff there, and we take on, followed by on the 31st of May, we're in Craven Cottage taking on Italy, a 7:45 kickoff there. These first two games, is there a chance over the course of the friendlies, Joe, that we're going to see Martin O'Neill pick two different teams maybe? I know he's the type of manager that gives a lot of preference to the club games and will take into account that players will be tired at this time of year.
I'd like to think so, yeah. And there's been a lot of reports in the press, especially I think since the turn of the year, about Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane appearing at league games up and down England. Well, the squad hasn't been announced yet. You know, we'd have to imagine that some of the players that have impressed them will be included. Possibly, you know, we could see a raft of first caps been awarded in the next four games. I think that there's been a lot of talk around. I think Sean Murray's been mentioned and Tommy Hoban both with Watford. There's the perennial question of whether or not Stephen Ireland is going to find. I think the two games, in Aviva Stadium and in Craven Cottage would give an excellent opportunity for players to stake their case, you know, before the business end things kicks off in the second half of the year with the qualifiers. As the two games in the States, you know, Costa Rica and Portugal are both obviously building up to the World Cup campaign. Costa Rica, I think, are looking to play, and English have England in the World Cup group. So, you know, they're looking to play maybe a team with the English, kind of the rough and tumble type of game,
yeah.
Well, I think that's probably the unfair reputation to it. I mean, it's understandable given that most of our players do play in England. Another thing I'd like to see maybe in the two games in the States is that, you know, there was talk during Staunton's reign that players who qualified for Ireland under parentage or grandparentage rules from that were playing in the States would be called up, but it actually never happened. I think Ronnie O'Brien infamously turned down the opportunity to train with the squad. But now there's Shane O'Neill, who was born in Middleton and Cork, is turning out regularly for the Colorado Rapids in the MLS. He actually played against Robbie Keane's LA Galaxy at the weekend. He called into Westman's national team, the senior team. So, you know, there could be an opportunity there for him maybe to be called into the squad, even if it's just to have a look at him and maybe get involved with him. So I don't think the date for the squad announcement is available yet, but I think a lot of people will be looking forward to it. Eagerly looking forward.
Indeed, it's going to be exciting. Philip, to come to yourself, as we were talking about, we're not sure what the squad is going to be, and if Martin O'Neill will pick two different teams, one squad, for the match against Turkey, followed by the game against Italy, and then another squad for the USA trip. Joe mentioned Steve Staunton's reign and the time he took them to the States, and I do remember Stan had a lot of problems getting players together, and it resulted in a cap for States. Joe Lapira, which was really interesting, the first time he ever played for Ireland and the last time as well. But having said that, what kind of squad do you think is going to go over to America?
I think he's going to have to be careful what he does here, because at the same time as you're going to want to try out an awful lot of new players, you're also looking at something which is Italy are looking for a good game, right? Costa Rica are looking for a good game. Both of them are going to play against England. And as Joe was saying, they're looking for a test that's going to be sort of England light, if you know what I mean. Now, I think that with that in mind, Martin O'Neill is going to want to bring along players who will impress. So it might be that you get a lot of guys who haven't had a chance before now, but he'll also want to, you know, there's a kind of a code of conduct there amongst international managers that, you know, if Martin was to turn up with essentially an under-21 team, I don't think that the Costa Ricans or the Italians would be too impressed. So whereas they want a good test, the best way to do that is to get guys who actually have something to play for, guys who want to make their way into the squads now come August, September, when the Euro qualifiers are about to start there. So I think Martin's probably going to go with that. There will be the few tried and trusted players. I'd say the spine down the middle of the field will probably be players who know what it's about to play in international football. And then sort of on the wings and up front, I think you're going to see fellas who are getting their first taste of international action.
How do you think, Philip, we're going to do in these friendlies? I mean, Costa Rica, they're in the World Cup. I know you were chatting to one of the Costa Rican players there recently, and there's a bit about them. They've got a couple of good players, and indeed they want to get a good test from us, as Joe was saying, because they're going to be playing England, so this type of style of football, that's why they picked us. In fact, I know it was quite funny, they had articles written incorrectly saying they were playing Northern Ireland, and then the IFA were getting involved saying, well, that's news to us and all. It was a bit of a mess from a media perspective.
Yeah, the first thing, I met Celso Borges, who's the central midfielder for Costa Rica, and I met him the other day, you know, and he said that whole thing between Ireland and Northern Ireland, it drove everybody mad. So we started off the interview with a quick sort of 5-minute history lesson for Celso about how the whole thing worked. So he's well prepared now, he knows exactly what to expect, but he filled me in a little bit on about the Costa Rican team and the way they play and that kind of thing, and he gave me a few players to watch. He himself plays here in Stockholm for AIK, pretty much a complete midfielder, well able to pass, very tactically aware, great man to shoot from distance. I think it was against Panama he scored an absolutely stunning goal there in the World Cup, in the CONCACAF World Cup qualifiers. Alongside him in the midfield is a guy called Yeltsin Tejeda, and Yeltsin is kind of a little bit like their Roy Keane. He's still only 21 or 22, but he has a good, I think he might have 24 caps at this point in time. Very aggressive guy, learning his trade as he goes along. He plays for one of the domestic clubs there. There's a winger there called Christian Bolaños as well that we should be looking at. And Umana at the back is also a very good player. And Diaz, like, they have an awful lot of very good players. They're not in the World Cup, you know, to make up the numbers. These guys came second to the USA in their qualifying group. And if they had started a little bit better, they probably would have won. Actually, they lost one game, I think, away to the US, which is basically they played in snow. And, the Costa Rican players being used to the sunshine, they were suicidal leaving the pitch. They just wanted to get off.
They're a little bit similar to us In their World Cup group, Philip, the fact that when we were going into the Euros, three teams that we feel were completely way above us, they probably looking similar like that with the likes of England and Uruguay in there.
Remarkably not, Dave, and like with very good reason. The Costa Ricans do not believe for a second that England or Italy are any better than they are, and this is the difference in mentality there. You know, I was saying to Celso, you know, you're going to be facing Pirlo, you're going to be facing Steven Gerrard, and he looked me in the eye and he pretty much said, look, at those guys, you know, they're the same as me, they just happen to play in better leagues, I haven't got there yet, you know.
Yeah.
So there's an awful lot of self-confidence in them. They're very much, you know, Costa Rican league football in general is quite like the Brazilian style of play. It's a little bit more laconic, there's a little bit more emphasis on dribbling, and it's not as tactically astute and that kind of thing. But the national team is markedly different, and they kind of model themselves on the Italian teams, the Italian team that won the World Cup and that kind of thing. They want to be very, very organized in defense, and then they want to counterattack. They want to hit you on the break as quickly as possible. And this tends to surprise teams like Italy and England. They don't expect them to do it. They kind of expect a guy to go and try and beat sort of four people, fall over his own legs, and then sort of hand them the ball, you know. But that's not going to happen with this team. And I was looking at the prices this morning for Costa Rica to make it out of the group. Some bookies have them at 66-1. And I mean, it's worth, if you have a euro left over there after the podcast is recorded, go and stick it on them to make it out of the group.
Yeah, that's fair play. A terrific insight there, Philip, into the Costa Rican team. Joe, it's going to be an exciting few friendlies. In fact, I've booked a bit of time off work for just to make sure I'm at the game in Dublin. Obviously, I'll watch the match, then the rest of the games. I know you're making the trip, I think, over to the States, and you're going to take in some of these friendlies. Just to let listeners know, the friendly against Costa Rica is on the Saturday, the 7th of June at 4 o'clock our time, and the friendly against Portugal is on Tuesday, the 10th of June at 4 o'clock our time. They're exciting friendlies.
Dave, I've been planning to hold this in the States for a little while now, and then when the two games were announced, I decided to work around that. So I've been to two games in the States before. I was at a pre-season friendly a few years ago when Celtic played Liverpool. And it was, remember, I think it was Gabriel Cissé's first game for Liverpool. He came on and scored twice. And I think it was maybe the first time I saw Aidan McGeady play as well live. So there's the two games in Philadelphia and New Jersey. I mean, there's obviously a big Irish community in Philadelphia, so I'm hoping for a lot of support there. And I think we all remember, you know, playing Italy in New Jersey in World Cup in 94. I don't know if it'll be the same kind of turnout, but I'm definitely hoping there'll be a big Irish audience coming down from around New York as well.
And Joe, Philip talked about there being a bit of a code of conduct between international managers, in the sense that these teams that are all going to the World Cup, bar Turkey, they all want to prove a point and they want us to bring a good team. Do you see that happening? I mean, Martin O'Neill is obviously going to look at the likes of James McCarthy and Seamus Coleman, who've played literally every game for Everton in a long season, and think, well, maybe these guys deserve a rest. What do you think?
I think there's a little of that, but I mean, we have to remember that these are the last four games that the team is going to play before the qualifiers start in September, now that the August friendly has been removed from the international calendar. So, you know, it's not just that, you know, the code of conduct between managers, but it could be the last chance for some of these players to get noticed or to be called into the squads for the games for September. So I think that's obviously going to be weighing on the players' minds. I mean, if you decide, you know, maybe it's time to rest up at the end of the season, it could come back to haunt you in a few months' time.
A lot of them are also involved in end-of-season clashes like playoffs. I know you have Wigan, Derby, QPR, Brighton as well with Stephen Ward there. So there's a lot of Irish involvement in the playoffs. This, maybe they'll get excused, or will they? At Hull as well in the FA Cup final.
Yeah, I think definitely for the first two games, the Turkey game is on the day after the playoff final. I mean, like you said there, Derby, Brighton, QPR and Wigan are all involved in the semi-finals. So we could see Jeff Hendrick, Richard Keogh, Keith Andrews, Stephen Ward, Kevin Doyle, Richard Dunn, Chris and James McLean all possibly involved in the playoff final. You know, the FA Cup final is a week beforehand. You might decide just to give David Mailer and Shane Long and Stephen Quinn, you know, a week just to recover from that and then bring them over to the States. So I think the full strength squad, I'd say, will probably be in the two games in the States come the beginning of June.
Okay, Philip, just a quick point before we go. are we doing England a favour in our friendly selections for this? Because we're taking on two of their opponents, and obviously the English management team will be keeping a close eye on our games and to see what the likes of Costa Rica and Italy are going to be offering. It might be a bit of a bizarre suggestion, but it was quite similar when we played before the 2010 World Cup. I think we took on Algeria or someone that was in England's group.
I don't think so. I think it's kind of lazy a lot of the time because, you know, you look at it, Costa Rica will look at this and they'll say, okay, Italy as well. Well, we'll pick Ireland. Who's to say that Ireland play anything like England? That Ireland play anything like England under Martin O'Neill? We've seen it a few times here, you know, where somebody's picked to play Sweden, or we'll go play Denmark, and the two countries have absolutely nothing in common in terms of football. They have a totally different way of playing it. So I think that, you know, that kind of thing, you're nearly as well off to go to a coach and say, look at, you know, can you play a 4-4-2 and hoof the ball up there? Can you play a 4-3-3 and do this and try to do that kind of thing? Like, do it in internal games or whatever. I know in American football, it's very, very common for backup quarterbacks to be asked to play like a certain player. And that's their job, is basically to mimic the moves of the other team every time they're going to meet them. So I think it's, you know, the idea that we might be doing them a favour, I don't think so. I think, as Joe mentioned earlier on, the only thing they get is the rough and tumble, the team spirit, the idea that the Irish will fight to the death. How much Costa Rica and Italy learn about England from playing Ireland, I don't think it'll be a whole lot.
And just on the games against Portugal and that, Philip, our players will get to have tests. And as Joe was saying, Martin O'Neill, these games are actually, you know, our friendly matches before the real business starts on the 7th of September away to Georgia. So playing the likes of Portugal, Italy and Turkey in particular, it's going to prepare. As Martin O'Neill said, he wanted tough games, and these are all tough games. It's hard to envision us running away with any of them.
No, but the thing is, Dave, that you never learn anything from playing bad teams. If you want to learn about your own team and if you want to learn about your own players, you have to put them up against the best. The Portuguese team, they beat Sweden to make it to the World Cup. They're an outstanding football team. They're outstandingly disciplined. Their attack is absolutely tremendous. The way they find one another is just outstanding. And how we defend against that is going to say a lot, you know. And I think that there's actually more benefits for us in playing Portugal than there is for England and Costa Rica playing against us, so to speak. Because, you know, whatever we learn against Portugal, we can take that then into the game against Georgia and say, look, remember what we did there, we're going to do that differently. So I think the big winners in all of these games that we're playing against such quality opposition is actually going to be the Irish national team.
Well, I hope you're right. Philip O'Connor and Joe McCarthy, thanks a million for joining us. If you'd like to sponsor, advertise or simply get involved with any of the shows on talkingsport.org, drop us an email to dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. Pete Kelly of Extra Time joins me now to talk about the Carlsberg Salt Hill Devon National Five-a-Sides. Pete, it's taking place from the 31st of May to the 1st of June. It's the bank holiday weekend, a fantastic celebration of football while watching five-a-side action. Tell us a little bit about these Carlsberg National Fives.
Well, Dave, it's nothing new as such. We've been running the event now, the event that I've been heavily involved in myself since 1977. So this year will be the 38th Fives. And we've seen thousands of teams and everything over the years. We've normally been very, very lucky with the weather. It's held in Salt Hill Park, which is in the heart of the resort in Galway. And in the back of the Salt Hill Park, and for anybody listening outside Galway, it's beside the Leisureland complex. There's a kind of a natural amphitheatre in the back with grass banks, and that's where people can lie out on the hills in the balmy weather, and it's always good weather at the Fives.
Quite lucky. 38 years is remarkable, Pete. How has it been so successful that you've been able to keep it going for so long?
It's hard to say, you know. When we started that competition first, and we built it as the National Fives, we got a lot of abuse from people to say that we were, you know, for being a bunch of cheeky gits, just to call anything national. But over the years, you know, we've had, you know, lots of pro teams, lots of League of Ireland guys used to come and play. Now, that changed somewhat when the League of Ireland season moved to the summer. And, you know, needless to say, the League of Ireland managers will not let their players play in it because of fear of injury and stuff like that, you know. But over the years, we've had a mixture, a lot of League of Ireland clubs and local teams and just guys who want to come and play fives. And the nature of the game in fives, it means that, you know, a bunch of lads, you know, from down the road can come up against a League of Ireland standard side and actually beat them. You know, that's the, it's the beauty of it.
Because I was just thinking there when you were mentioning it about League of Ireland players back in the past when they used to come down and play, and when the league actually moved to the summer, it kind of stopped that officially because obviously the clubs weren't going to release them. But having said that, you know, it just goes to show how summer soccer has developed here in Ireland, because if League of Ireland players were coming down, they obviously liked playing on good surfaces in the summer with good facilities, and that maybe that quietly contributed to the league actually going into the summer.
Well, it may have, because I know for years previous to that, you know, there used to be all sorts of summer tournaments. You know, in Dublin, a lot of the guys who were home on holidays, you know, from the pro clubs in England would always play under assumed names, allegedly, as they say in Dublin, because the clubs would go daft. There were summer leagues in Donegal, 11-a-side leagues for years that they used to have big prize money out of. So, you know, there's always been a sort of, there's always been a, you know, a history of running summer events. And I think one of the great attractions, I think, over the years of this five-a-side tournament is that it was purely knockout for years. We had teams who came from the United States and played 10 minutes. It's 5 minutes a side and just watched for the rest of the time, you know, as well as frequenting the local hostelries and things like that. But, you know, so it was one of the things that people found it difficult to understand, that people would turn up for a knockout tournament. But they did. A slightly different format this year in that we're keeping the entry down to 100 teams. We have had up to 140 odd teams in this tournament. And everybody's guaranteed a second chance. So there's a played competition. If you're beaten in the first round, you get a chance in the played competition.
A backdoor kind of thing.
A backdoor. You're going to give everybody, but it's a separate competition.
Right.
You're going to give everybody at least two bites of the cherry. And I think that's only fair in this day and age of a lot of people traveling to Galway for the weekend. Apart from having a great time, they're at least going to get two games. You know.
Yeah, because I'm thinking if you're playing five-a-side football, and you know when teams are just kind of getting together and they need a little bit of time to learn from their mistakes. If it's quite cruel if they're gone straight away, as you said, coming over from the United States, getting 10 minutes and then being finished. Yeah. Like, that's probably a key point, and that perhaps you've seen a lot of successful teams that have maybe lost their first game but organized themselves and then went on.
Oh yeah, there is. You know, if the last two or three years now, we offered an option for people to buy back into the tournament. You know, they could pay a 50 quid fee and get into the secondary tournament. But this year we've decided, look, we roll it all into one. You get two bites of the cherry. There's only one entry, and you're automatically in the draw for the played competition if you're beaten in the first round. Now, that wouldn't have been the way over the years when we had League of Ireland sides, when we had pure League of Ireland sides, because, you know, in the past, it was particularly in the 90s, you had people like Shelburne won this in 1990, won it again in 92. Galway United, as it was constituted at the time with their full League of Ireland squad played, were in around the same time. Shamrock Rovers have won it a couple of times with their full, you know, pro teams. And, you know, over the years, you had people like Pat Fennan was the player of the tournament, for instance, in 1997. And he's gone on to, you know, serious things in the world of management. But when he was a young player, I don't know how many guys listening out here remember when Fennan was a really good young player and played with Chelsea. And Fennan was a fantastic player. And Fives really showed off his skills. People like Robbie Brown from Shelburne, he was a player of the tournament another year. So Derek Tracy, he was a great striker with Rovers. So you had a lot of those caliber of players have played in the tournament over the years. Pat Byrne, another one. So, you know, you've had, and then now there's newer guys coming in that people may not know, but they're quality players as well. And one of the star players in last year's tournament was Alex Byrne. He was a local Salt of Devon player who has now signed for the new Galway FC. Made his debut on Friday night there against Waterford and had a particularly good game as centre-back, and he's certainly a star of the future.
Fantastic. I think when you said Pat Byrne there, I'm thinking he might have been the only League of Ireland player to ever get a competitive cap for the international team when he was at Shamrock Rovers, I think.
I think competitive cap, yes, I think you're probably right. I know some guys have played in friendlies in the past. Pat Byrne was a quality midfield player, you know, saw time at Leicester and Hearts and things like that. So he was, and we had him as a guest of honour. We've had several of these guys as guest of honours over the year, and you know, they've been very, very good. You've also had some flamboyant characters, the likes of Paul O'Zam, who played in the tournament on several occasions. and he's a real larger-than-life character as well.
I always wonder, Pete, what it's like, and I always ask the lads that I play five-a-side what it would be like having like a professional player. And I asked, we had Liam Murray off Wybig on the show last week, and I asked him about the Damien Duff tournament and what it would be like having top players playing in that five-a-side, because it's very different. It's all about your touch, first touch, skill, technique. It's a almost a pressure cooker environment to be playing five-a-side. So as you said, when you have big names like that coming down, they must really show off the skills. And as you said, the likes of Pat Fenlon over the years as well.
Yeah, the big difference you see between the guys who have played at League of Ireland level and your average junior player is the League of Ireland guys look to hold the ball all the time. They don't give it away easy, whereas the local lads would tend to, you know, to try something that they're not capable of and give it straight back to the guys once they get it. So when you're playing against the better players, it can be really frustrating because they just don't give it to you easily. You've got to work your pants off to get it. And, you know, getting it off them is not easy. You've only got 10 minutes. So once you get past the first couple of rounds,
yeah,
the format is really mitigates in favor of the better teams. Because as you get on, it's getting harder to play. It's getting quicker. You're getting tired. And the better players hang on to the ball better. And the name of the game in five-a-sides is hold the ball.
Exactly. It sounds terrific. And the fives event, it's not just a great football festival, but it also gives teams, a lot of the teams that have endured kind of a pretty long season in their leagues, whatever leagues they're playing in, they get to travel to Galway and kind of enjoy somewhat of an end of season celebration as well.
Well, it is, and we get a lot of teams that come down as a kind of like their weekend away type of thing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the season, and they do come and play. We also have an over 35s tournament, which, you know, we'll probably see 16-24 teams, which is, you know, we've just decided to run that in the last couple of years, and that's starting to get some real traction. And you get a lot of the older guys in that, like it's over 35, but you're getting a lot of guys up in the 50 age bracket playing. And you see some, it's played at a lower pace, but you see some great football in it as well.
It's quite a festival atmosphere now. I was looking at the photos on the Salt Hill Fives website. You seem to have been very lucky with the weather. There's no doubt about that. But yeah, a real festival atmosphere, like a small music festival or something, but everybody's going to watch football and they're sitting on the hills and that. It's so obviously great for people that aren't just involved, great for people to get down and have a bit of crack, not just for the players.
Yeah, well, if the sun is shining, we always say down here, if the sun is shining on the Sunday afternoon, you will have a few thousand people in the park watching the final stages. And you literally got 20 hours of football, you know, from early Saturday morning, you know, with a start about 10:30, right through to about 7 o'clock on Saturday evening. And then on Sunday, you know, you're running from 10:30 in the morning right through to 6 o'clock. And we you know, we have some additional things as well as the over 35s. We have an under 10 competition, and there's an under 13 competition. And the final of the under 13s is always played just before the main final, you know, when there's a maximum amount of people there. And those kids get, you know, a great, great buzz out of that. They would be predominantly local teams. But you've found over the years that some kids who've done well in the under 13s, because we've run for so long, have ended up coming along and winning the main competition. There's a well-known character here in Galway, played at Galway United for years, called John Carr. And he won both at under 13 and came back and won the main tournament and was actually named player of the tournament in the main tournament at one point. He's a veteran now, and he actually turned out last year in the over 35. So he has the kind of mantle of fives royalty, as it were. And and there's a lot of other local lads who've played in the fives their entire adult life, you know.
I was thinking there as well, Pete, about it's good for the mentality around soccer in Ireland to have things like this, because we want to go away from the whole attitude that, say, China has, where if you're going to play football, you're going to be a professional. You don't play it for the fun. Whereas in Brazil, you have doctors, everybody plays, you know, will play it on the beach, and you'll always have these type of football festivals where everybody goes down to watch it. That's what we should be getting. And I know good people like yourself and other football people in Ireland were trying to bring the casual approach to soccer and just get people involved in one way or another.
Yeah, well, I tell you, you know, I think that's what it is, and it's about promoting the game at the grassroots level in whatever way and enjoying it, really. And I'll tell you, Dave, if you could get a world's talking five-a-side team with your mates that you normally play five-a-side with, then we will invite you guys to come and play in the tournament. We'll give you a special free entry into the tournament if you can organise a team for that weekend to come down, and we'll, you know, and we'll entertain you. We'd love to have you down on the tournament. And there you go. So you could have the radio team, as it were, in the tournament.
It would be very interesting indeed, especially with with the tactical analysis there that I'm sure I'd give out to all my teammates.
Exactly. Well, you can even stand on the sideline and roar at them to run faster or something.
Exactly,
you know, something like that.
Exactly. You have David Ford as an ambassador, I've seen. Fantastic for Galway, yeah. Fantastic for you guys. I know he was named Millwall Player of the Season and for That's keeping nice. Millwall in the Championship. Absolutely. Huge player to have involved.
Well, Ford has become a real local hero, and he's played for a couple of local clubs. He actually did play for Saltill Devon for a couple of seasons at 13 and 14, and then he played for Galway Hibernians before joining what was Galway United, and then setting off on his football odyssey, as it were. He's an absolute model professional. He's an iconic figure, a guy for any kid to follow in Galway, to say, look at how this guy has behaved himself, as well, apart from his footballing ability, how he has conducted himself both on and off the pitch throughout his professional career is exemplary. And he played in the fives on numerous occasions when in his younger days, and is a great friend to Galway soccer and a great friend to the five-a-sides. And, you know, he's the sort of lad that will help us out at any opportunity. We're delighted to be associated, and we were over the moon, you know, when he got that award again last night. And he thoroughly deserved it because, you know, he was the barn door for a lot of the season that kept them in that division.
Yeah, I mean, the, you know, balls were raining down from every angle into that towards that Millwall goal, and he had a real great performance. As you said, you can only get better when you're being tested, and in every single match he was most definitely being tested. Maybe perhaps a couple of clubs in the Premier League might take a look at him now, particularly that he's playing international football.
Oh yeah, I think the problem he has is age. You know, the guys are not prepared. You know, somebody might be prepared to make him an offer, you know, to use his backup. And I don't think he should take that. I don't think he would want to do 40. He wants to play every single week. You know, maybe Millwall will have a change of fortunes this coming season. And, you know, they could be in contention. I think, you know, at his age, he's got to play every single week to be in the international squad. And I think above all else at this stage, he wants to continue in the Irish squad to be the number one, and I think he'll get that chance until something proves otherwise, because O'Neill and Keane, I think, will be loyal to the guys who've dug them out, you know. So I think he's got a few years left in him yet. Goalkeepers go on longer than a lot more than other outfield players, and he looks after himself very, very well.
Fantastic. And just before I let you go, Pete, I have to ask you, for anybody looking to get involved or even find out more information about the festival, maybe take a trip down, what's the best way and how much does it cost to enter?
Well, it's €120 to enter a team. You can check it out on Facebook at the National Fives, Saltill Devon, which is www.saltilldevon.ie. There's a Twitter account for National Fives at National Fives, and you get two games for that for your entry fee. But if you just Google it, your National Fives, you'll find it. And we'd love to see people down there. As I said, it's on the 31st of May and the 1st of June, and entries will close about 5 days beforehand. And it's from now on that the entries stream in, and we'd love to have anybody there from anywhere, including the Dave O'Grady five-a-side specials.
I'll see what I can do. And you might need to pull a few strings, but I will try my best. I was reading
that. Get you a bite to the semi-final or something.
Yeah, a couple of maybe bribe a couple of referees. Yeah. Actually, you have professional referees there. There's over 100 teams, amphitheater style that is Salthill Park.
Absolutely.
Great football, scenery, drama, and crack. It's terrific. Pete Kelly, thanks a million for joining us.
Dave, thank you very much indeed.
If you'd like to sponsor, advertise, or simply get involved with any of the shows on TalkingSport.org, drop us an email to dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. Joining me now to catch up on all the League of Ireland goss over the past few weeks is Ronan Murphy of Goal Ireland. Ronan, thanks a million for joining me. one of the major talking points has to be Cork City's defeat by Dundalk. Dundalk 4, Cork City 0. I couldn't believe it when I was watching the highlights and reading. I was following it on Flash Score, and I simply couldn't believe it. And I felt a little bit guilty that I might have put a curse on John Caulfield when I had him on the show last week. I said it's not going to be a walk in the park, and he kind of agreed with me. But Dundalk, serious title contenders now and proving a point with that win.
Oh, they definitely are. A lot of people had them down as title contenders, at least at the start of the season. But I think the match on Friday was a huge boost to them, especially after the loss to Bray and the last minute goal against Athlone. It's kind of the wake up call they might have needed, because with Stephen O'Donnell gone, they hadn't scored a goal from open play, and it seemed like they might have been missing them coming into the match against Cork. But they definitely controlled things, and it's a huge result for them, and it really puts them as title contenders.
What about the unbeaten run, as you said, coming to an end? Could John Caulfield magic that into a positive, Ronan, in the sense that maybe they can say, well, there's a monkey off our backs now, you know, we weren't sure when this unbeaten run was going to end, but now we can learn from that and kick on. There's a little bit less pressure now that we finally lost a game.
Yeah, it probably will help them, because at least they can just focus on one game at a time, and they don't have to think, oh yeah, we're now 11 games unbeaten or 10 games unbeaten or whatever. So it's just that they can focus on one game at a time. And Caulfield, he's always great for making the halftime substitutions, and even seeing it against Dundalk, it was too late by the time he made but they were already 3-0 down at that stage. But they did look much improved in the second half, and you'd imagine he would have learned a lot from the defeat. So hopefully he can use the match to gee up the players a bit, maybe, and then they might be able to turn things around this weekend.
Yeah, they'll be looking to certainly turn things around this weekend. Well done to Dundalk there, and Pat Hoban, of course, scoring twice in that game. Remarkable stuff. Drogheda defeated again, Ronan, and they continue to slide down the table. I know when we were talking earlier in the season, it was exciting stuff, and they were putting a good few performances together, and the goals were coming, and we had Fabio on and all this kind of thing. But they had a great start. They've now lost 5 in a row, and on Friday they really let a lead slip against UCD. Is their small squad starting to take its toll?
Well, I think that kind of is like what you said about John Caulfield there. We had Declan O'Brien and we jinxed him, and they haven't won since, so must be something going on. But I think Declan even said it himself, that they would find it difficult because of the size of their squad. And if they did pick up injuries or suspensions, they would find it harder. So I think they could have held on against UCD, but UCD have a fine young squad, and they're always capable of producing some young talent. So they were able to come back in the match. But the next couple of matches for Drogheda will probably help shape their season one way or another. But I'd imagine they'll finish in mid-table, because Robbie Horgan seems to have a good start to the season, and I'd say he can get them back to taking points off the teams that are around them in the table.
Yeah, and from a UCD point of view as well, I mean, they're on 11 points in the league. There's really nothing between them and 5th place Sligo Rovers. There's about 4 points there, and you know, with a run of games, they can certainly make their way up the table. However, in 12th place is Athlone Town, Ronan, but they finally got some points on the board. Fair play, nil all draw against Bray Wanderers. I didn't see it, I wasn't in Athlone for this one, but I can't imagine it was one for the football elitist.
Well, it's good that Keith Long has actually got a point on the board, and they can put the whole Mick Cook departure and everything behind him with a positive result in his first game. But mainly they almost won it with a late penalty, so they could have even had 3 points on the board. But you'd have to think that Long does have his work cut out trying to salvage things from here, because you're after saying that UCD have 11 points already, and looking at Lone with their one, they need to get a few wins before the mid-season break if they're to have any chance of even making the relegation playoff, never mind staying up.
Yeah, no, it's a long hill mountain really ahead of Athlone Town this year. Waterford United, they have financial troubles. The first division side, Ronan, they're struggling. They're looking to cut players to save money. it's very difficult on the club, staff, players, fans, because they are a good club. I know we've had John Delaney on a few times, and he has the big soft spot there for Waterford, and it's a good, he always talks about it being a great footballing city and that, but hopefully they're not going to follow in the footsteps of Fingal, Kildare, Monaghan. Hopefully not. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, they had the meeting, and I think the players and the staff and everyone will want to make sure that they don't follow in the footsteps of Fingal and the others. But I think it's difficult for first division teams, maybe more so than Premier Division teams, because they have such distances to travel. You look at Waterford, and they have away games against Finn Harps and Galway, and it's a lot of expense on the team. And we had Mick Wallace on a few weeks ago, and he was saying that Wexford youths are even losing money, the players themselves. It's costing them to go to away matches. So it's hard for the first division clubs to make ends meet. And even I think Waterford, actually, there more people are coming out this season than last season to the matches. But I think they'll need a couple of glamour friendlies like last season's against Man United and Crystal Palace, where I think they had nearly 3,000 at the RSC for the Man United match. So if they could get a couple of games like that, you could imagine they'll be able to get a bit of money, gate receipts through the door, and hopefully get some fans coming that may have not been coming so far this season. But it's very difficult for any club in Ireland making ends meet, and with lack of sponsorship and lack of gate receipts, it's hard to make ends meet. So hopefully, fingers crossed, they will turn things around down there.
What about the point that the fact that they're a city and the fact that they've got a really good history there, would that stand to them? Whereas when we've seen Sporting Fingal come on the scene, really they took the leagues by storm in their short success. Does Waterford's history maybe stand to them? And if they can get more of the city involved in the club, like we've seen Galway starting to do now, that can be a way out.
Oh, I think you're definitely right there. If you look at what Cork have done as well, they're kind of galvanised the city, and they're getting huge fans in Turner's Cross. And Waterford do have this long history in the League of Ireland. So with Fingal, they were trying to start things afresh and win new fans in Dublin. So that was always an uphill battle. But Cork, they're getting 600, 700 to the games, which are decent crowds. So if they can actually to get some of them fans that are coming through the doors to maybe give a few extra euro here and there, they might actually be able to make ends meet. Maybe they need some sort of a fundraising campaign, and like we've seen from Spanish teams like Oviedo and some of the English teams, maybe if the fans helped invest in the club, it could secure the long-term future of the club.
Well, hopefully Waterford will. It'll be an upward curve with difficult times down there in a great city, great club. Let's look at the Setanta Sports Cup final, Ronan, because it's been hosted in Talla Stadium, and Dundalk are going to take on Sligo Rovers, two teams which, you really looking at the table now, Sligo are really making the push up and Dundalk are having a terrific season, but in the cup it's all a different thing. It's going to be fantastic to see how it pans out. They're on a great run in the league, Sligo, as we said. It should be a great spectacle.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this weekend's final, all right. It should be a great match, and both of them can win their first Setanta Cup. So both teams will definitely be trying their utmost to win it. And as you say, both of them are on great runs in the league, with Dundalk at the top at the moment and Sligo are 5 or 6 games undefeated. So there's plenty to play for, and two exciting attacking teams. So as long as they get a good turnout in Talla, because it's a neutral venue and a fair distance from both sides, it should be a cracker of a game.
When the Setanta Sports Cup first came about, Ronan, I was doing my leaving cert at the time, and I remember Shelburne were playing the likes of Linfield, and I used to be listening to the Linfield manager talking about how fantastic of, you know, a cup it was, bringing all the teams together. But over the past few years, it really has had its run of problems. I mean, we've seen the likes of Cliftonville and Linfield pull out of it, two of the biggest teams in the north. I know former Cork City player Neil Horgan, he mooted an All-Ireland League in his Examiner column this week. What do you think? Is that a viable idea? You know, we're too small of a country as a whole to, I suppose, have two leagues. What do you think is the future here?
Well, I don't think Horgan's idea is the worst one. I think the problems with the Setanta Cup are are more scheduling than anything else, because if you look at the teams that pulled out, or even the Northern Irish teams that did compete this season, they had their minds somewhere else. They're focusing on the end of their season because they are still in a winter season, whereas we're in a summer season. So if the two leagues were combined, there'd be no scheduling issues. But I suppose the only thing you have to look at then is the costs involved of running a thing like that. It's a long way from Cork to Belfast to be going for a match.
So, I know.
But I suppose it's done with Derry City being in the League of Ireland, so teams are used to travelling that kind of length of a distance. So it could be a gore if you could get sponsorship and the money on board. And I know Horgan said in the column that it wouldn't be a problem for European football either, because he was using the example of the Belgian and Netherlands combining in the Women's European League, and the highest placed team from both jurisdictions then get a place in Europe regardless of who wins the title. So
yeah, because that was a major dispute there, because if they were to bring the league together into one All-Ireland league, losing a European place was a problem. But that seems to be a very good idea, actually.
Yeah, it does seem to be one, and I think they had proposed something like that if the Russian and Ukrainian leagues had joined together, like was proposed by Gazprom there for next season. But I think with the political situation over there, that doesn't seem like a goer anymore. But you could imagine the people have found solutions before the problems have even existed for some of these problems. So I suppose from the financial side of things is the big question that would need to be solved before you'd be able to get an All-Ireland League on. But it could be interesting. It'd be really competitive, because we've seen a lot of the Northern Irish teams do well enough in Europe, and we've seen a lot of the former League of Ireland players go up to the Irish League. And
they
and
have, but there, can the argument not be made, though, in recent times, Ronan, that the League of Ireland teams just look so much ahead of the Irish Premiership teams?
Well, I think that's harking back to what I said earlier about scheduling. It's because the League of Ireland teams, it's when they started, it's in pre-season and their players are fully fit, whereas the Irish League teams, they're after playing 20, 30, 40 games already, and they're either battling relegation or trying to get into Europe or something. So putting out their strongest side in the Setanta Cup isn't an option for many of them. And then we do see these strange 5-0, 6-1, whatever results, like Ballymallard suffered, say. So it's difficult for the Irish League teams, and you can see why they don't value the Setanta Sports Cup as highly as they might do their own domestic league.
Yeah, well, it's still going to be a cracking game, no doubt about that. This Saturday, 10th of May in Tallaght Stadium, should be a cracker. Ronan Murphy, thanks a million for joining me.
You're most welcome, Dave. Thanks for having me.
We're almost out of time here on the Why Big Football Show, but just before I leave you, I want to bring you up to date with the Airtricity Premier Division table. Dundalk leading the way on 23 points. St. Patrick's Athletic and Cork make up second and third, with Shamrock Rovers climbing up to fourth position. Sligo Rovers climbing as well, now in fifth position after a slow start to the season. Derry City in sixth place with Bray Wanderers in seventh. Drogheda United, Bowes and Limerick make up 8th, 9th and 10th. And UCD and Athlone Town are in 11th and 12th. Athlone Town on 1 point now, and then UCD, big gap there. UCD on 11 points, joined with Limerick and Bowes down there. Look at the first division table. Shelburne still leading the way on 20 points. Wexford Utes in second place on 16, with Galway in third and Shamrock Rovers B in fourth. That's moving up the table there for Shamrock Rovers B team. Longford Town in fifth, Waterford United in sixth, and Finn Harps in seventh place with the bottom of the table. Cove Ramblers still lying down there on just 2 points. A couple of fixtures this week in the Premier Division on Friday night. Bowes are at home to UCD. Bray Wanderers take on Limerick, and Derry City take on Shamrock Rovers, while last year's champions St. Patrick's Athletic are at home to Cork City. Another belter there. We'll see if John Caulfield's men can bounce back. In the first division on Friday, Waterford United host Shelburne at 7:45, while on Saturday Longford Town take on Wexford Utes, a 7:30 kickoff there, while Cove Ramblers take on Finn Harps at 7:45 on Saturday. And on Sunday, Shamrock Rovers Bees host Galway FC at 3 o'clock. Well, that's it for tonight. My thanks to all our guests on the Why Big Football Show. I'm Dave O'Grady. Remember, if you want to contact us, you can email dave@talkingsport.org. That's dave@talkingsport.org. I look forward to reading some of your comments and feedback on tonight's show. Remember, the show is broadcast every week, so you can check out talkingsport.org or go to whybig.ie or any of those great Irish soccer sites. I hope you have a great weekend, and I'll chat to you soon.